The views and opinions expressed here are those of the guests, and are not the official position of The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints.
One of the most remarkable aspects of The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints is its unique history. Throughout the world, great stories from faithful church members have only added to that history. This program shares some of these incredible stories of faith, perseverance, hope, and inspiration. You're listening to Legacy. I'm your host, Nathan Wright.
I'm Matt Henderson, filling in for Nathan Wright. 3 months after the church was organized, the Lord, through the prophet Joseph Smith, instructed Joseph's wife, Emma, to make a selection of sacred hymns for the church. Music has always played an important role in religious worship. Latter-day Saints have a long tradition of music in their meetings, but few know the history behind their music. Joining me in studio today is Daniel Henderson. Daniel is a musician and teacher working in Boston, Massachusetts, where he lives with his wife, Michelle, and their two children. He received a Bachelor of Music degree from BYU, a Master of Music degree from the New England Conservatory of Music in Boston, and is working to complete his doctorate degree in music at the conservatory, specializing in jazz composition. While in Boston, Daniel has taught at Harvard University as a teaching fellow in jazz history. He currently teaches a graduate course at New England Conservatory on jazz and racial politics. Thanks for joining me.
Thank you.
So when you first started your doctoral work, you needed to do a research paper, a doctoral research paper, and you came up with an interesting topic. What, tell us about that.
Right. Well, I was fascinated when Gladys Knight converted to the church back in 1997, and I think I, along with many members of the church, watched with excitement as she interacted with President Hinckley in public forums, now and again. And to hear Gladys, first, I think Gladys represents what is happening in the church today, that no longer is the majority of the church from a similar cultural background, but rather we are going out and embracing hundreds of cultures that 50 years ago, we had, no presence of them in our LDS culture. So Gladys, was saying how excited she was to be a member of this church. She loved everything about the church except the music, and she and President Hinckley went back and forth in public venues, lovingly toward each other, with President Hinckley saying, Gladys quoted President Hinckley as saying, "Well, Gladys, I hear you're not satisfied with our music. Well, maybe you're going to have to do something about it." So, with President Hinckley saying, maybe you'll have to do something, and Gladys saying, sure, I definitely want to do something about it, I wanted to ask myself, where did we get this music in the first place? Why is Latter-day Saint music, particularly our hymns, why are our hymns the way that they are today? Somewhere along the line, someone had to make some very specific decisions to come up with what we have today as the current hymnal. And, so I was working here in Boston at New England Conservatory, and to my great surprise and delight, the further I dug into the history, the more I realized the incredible connection between New England, particularly Boston, and New England Conservatory, the influence they had on what we know today as our LDS hymn book. So that's why I got into this, the more I learned about it, the more I wanted to pursue it, and it's been a really kind of exciting scholarly adventure to get into this.
So we look at Boston at the time of the early church, 1830s. Just before that, Boston is a hot spot of change because of the country. I mean, we've organized our country, and Boston is a hot spot of change, I would imagine.
Right, you bet.
And so what was the predominant religion back there in Boston at the time, and what was music like then?
As you say, Boston was a major city. I mean, still is a major city, but back in the 1700s and 1800s, it was seen sort of as the cultural capital of the United States. Whatever was to come, whatever the United States would produce as art or music or high culture, generated typically from Boston. The music there, the religion was almost exclusively Protestant. And I guess especially important to Latter-day Saints that by the year 1830, Protestant religions in Boston had completed a massive overhaul, a massive reform, so to speak, of sacred music. That beginning in about 1720, clergy came forward saying that music is essential in our services, but it is dangerous, and we need to carefully control this music because it's getting out of hand. Mm. So the climate, in 1830 when the church is being formed is the end of a massive reform.
So we've got clergy in Protestant New England saying that music can be dangerous. What did they see about it that was dangerous?
Right. Music is dangerous. It needs to be controlled. What they saw was that, I can in fact read to you some from their pamphlets. Beginning in 1720, several Protestant clergymen published these pamphlets and gave public speeches about music. For instance, the first one coming from the Reverend Thomas Walter was published entitled "The Grounds and Rules of Music Explained." He taught that music in the church had been, and I quote, "miserably tortured and twisted and quavered in some churches into an horrid medley of confused and disorderly noises." So another of his contemporaries, Cotton Mather, another very popular preacher in the day in the Protestant church, the next year, 1721, he joined Reverend Walter and he published that singing had sort of fallen into what he called degeneracy. And he stated that the ridiculous ideas of the people have turned the singing of psalms into an odd noise, a confused noise, an uncouth noise. So the idea was that music needs to be orderly. And when music gets out of order, it is degeneracy, it is ridiculous, it is miserable, it is even apostasy to have that kind of music.
Now, I read in your paper, in one of the footnotes, one of the essays, the title of the essay, and I don't know if you want to read the title of that essay, because that that kind of says it all, just
right.
The title of this essay. From this is from a group of clergy, am I right, or is it just one?
Yeah, this is from a small group of clergy here that joined forces, have a little extra oomph behind their message here.
So this is the title of their essay.
Sure, the title of the essay is "An Essay by Several Ministers of the Gospel for the Satisfaction of Their Pious and Conscientious Brethren as to Sundry Questions and Cases of Conscience Concerning the Singing of Psalms in the Public Worship of God Under the Present Evangelical Constitution of the Church State."
That's just the title, not the entire essay.
Right, that is the title.
And if that doesn't make you want to sing with gusto, I don't know what will.
Right, exactly.
So this gives you an idea of where they're standing. I mean, they clearly were not happy.
Right, they weren't happy. And really what was happening in the music up to this point was great. It's music sort of similar to what we may see today in Pentecostal churches. The singing was robust. It was loud. It was often fast. There was improvisation. Some of the techniques that the musicians would use included lining out or call and response, in which the leader of the music would sing a line and the rest of the congregation would respond. Often they would respond by mimicking that line, by echoing it back to him, but in their own free way. And so you may have, several layers of different interpretations of the same line happening at the same time, but always with robust participation. And the clergy see this as a disorderly noise. They preferred something more quiet and orderly and uniform and predictable, because that was sort of the essence of the culture at the time, at least what the clergy were seeking for, both in their sermons and in the lifestyle of the people.
Interesting, the lining out or the call and response and all the different things you talk about. It's an awful lot like jazz today with the improvisation, the call and response. And it's interesting that jazz kind of got the same welcome when it first started for a lot of people.
That's true,
It was noise. It was irreverent and so on.
Right, yeah.
Wow. So you mentioned in your paper an old way and a new way of singing. Can you explain that to us? What they were referring to as the old way and the new way?
Right. The old way and the new way that ministers began to use them. The old way, these ministers described as this. This same group of ministers said, "One should not sing the worst he can. Thus, those that use the old way should change." So they describe this old way. When they use the word old, they don't mean just old-fashioned or it's something that used to be acceptable, but rather it's now out. The old way was this very improvisatory, free, complex, loud sort of music, and the new way was to be one of order. So attaching that word new to it really puts sort of a stigma on the way that had been popular among the people at the time.
And they used the word, if I remember right, decency.
Decency.
And how did they define that?
Yeah.
It's interesting that they say those who use the old way should change. Okay.
Right. Exactly. So, yeah, one of the main lines from these ministers was that let all things be done decently. So that was the question, is what does decently mean? And to these ministers, to sing decently required music notation. You need to eliminate the improvisation and the unpredictability from the music because that's not something that's able to be tightly controlled and, fit nicely into the service exactly the way the minister would want it. So decently essentially meant correct singing of correctly notated music, which had been approved by clergy. So, yeah, you give the congregation approved, correct music to sing, and you teach them to sing it in a correct way. This is what decently meant to them.
So, and you said notated music. Up to that point, had things not been notated? Or?
Right. Yeah, things had not been notated. Generally, you may have published books of texts, of psalms. You know, they may sing straight out of the Bible, sing psalms, or sing other what we may know as like a hymn text or a poem, just set to tunes that everyone would know.
And Emma's first book was just the lyrics, am I right?
Right. Emma's first book was just lyrics, and not just Emma's, but many, many subsequent hymn books were also just text clear into the early 1900s as well. The early Latter-day Saints did not read anything like what we have in our music today in our hymn book, but rather they have the text. They listen to the leader, and the leader decides what tune will accompany the text, and you go from there.
Hmm. And so they wanted, these clergy wanted to organize that, get that in such an order that he could, with his sermon today, we want to sing this song to this, we want it notated so that it, and you sing it properly so it doesn't distract from my sermon, so it's part of my sermon, or that was kind of basically the idea?
Yeah, that was the idea. And, what's interesting when you look back at the history is that these reformers saw music as a major problem in the service, yet never crossed their mind to eliminate music from the service. That would have been the easy solution.
Mm-hmm.
Say, you just come, you listen to my sermon, we pray, we go home. And you go and try to adapt these things. But rather, these clergy recognize that, when you combine music with religion, it often helps each of them to achieve their highest potential. You know, that man can achieve a high state of spirituality through music, and that music is able to go to a high state of art when you combine it with religious tones. And it was a similar idea to what the Catholic Church had encountered centuries earlier. The Catholic Church embraced music from the beginning and was seen as an important part of service. And over the centuries, musicians created more and more elaborate music. And eventually the church felt it was time to clamp down because the music was getting out of control and was distracting from the service. So again, rather than eliminate music, you just seek to harness it, to bridle it, to carefully, to make sure it's carefully unified and controlled in a way that the clergy believe is most suitable to fostering the spirit in the services.
So here's what I'm thinking. They decide we want all the music notated, and they get that done. What good does that do them? Because I'm guessing not a lot of people could read music.
Right. Not a lot of people could read music, and so that was that was where they required professional musicians to help. They said something needs to be done, and we know that something needs to involve notated music, the congregation needs to read. If we're going to do that, we need to teach the people how to do it. So these ministers set up what they called singing schools. And singing schools were run by professional musicians, and the goal was to teach members of the congregation and members of choirs to read from notated music. And these singing schools were popular for a century in the Protestant church once they got started. And, I mean, they were wildly successful, sometimes too successful, that musicians would take their training a bit too far and, you know, go overboard. And, you know, in a way it would backfire on the ministers when the musicians now said, look what we can do now that you've taught us, you know.
Well, yeah, I can imagine you've got the ministers who probably are not qualified to teach music
right.
to their congregation. So they right. bring in musicians who I am assuming have the same approach to music as the congregation, not the approach that the ministers have, I mean, at heart.
Right. That was the case for the first several decades, was that, you know, the musicians they brought in to do the singing schools and the musicians that were trained in the singing schools did not have the same motivations in general as the ministers did. That came later. There was sort of a second wave of reformers in the Protestant church coming, you know, near the end of the 1700s, where the musicians finally got on board and said, we want sacred music reform as well. And so once you had the clergy combining with the top professional musicians, then the reform was able to succeed. You know, it took 110 years until the reformers were satisfied with the way things looked in the church service.
So I'm guessing that these reformers have this agenda, and I'm betting the congregations didn't just fall in line.
Right. Yeah, they didn't. Many of them, you know, there was stiff resistance. There was bitter resistance among many of the congregation. In fact, let me read something to you here. There was an anonymous pamphlet published. You know, I think they felt the need for anonymity, knowing that they were going against these powerful ministers. You know, not against some great church leader, you know, or what we would know as a prophet or a president of the church, but local clergy were pretty powerful. This anonymous pamphlet asked the question, what rule of authority have you to impose your way on others? If you like one tune, mayn't they as well like another? So, I mean, this was sort of more trying to reason with them. That was one approach from the congregation. Another one was just to threaten to secede. You know, many of the church members publicly came out and said, rather than, you know, bend to your way, we will just secede from the church and start up a branch of the Church of England or something else. You know, we consider that better than to submit to what you're trying to put us through right now.
So I hadn't made this connection till you just said this, but so in New England, this is leading right into the time when Joseph Smith is a young man in Palmyra and there are all these religious revivals and probably a lot of separate churches that have maybe sprung off from this, where people seceded and started their own church or something. And that may, I hadn't realized that that may have led to all this revival in New England and all these tent revivals. And I know that singing was a big part of the tent revivals at the time of Joseph Smith when he was looking at all these different churches.
Right.
So these schools, these music schools, were controlled by the clergy. Were there others that sprang up? I would think that other people would want to say, hey, let's have our own music school. This music is quite the thing. Do you know anything about that? Were there others that just sprang up on their own, or do you know anything about that?
So there were singing schools that were directly controlled by the church. And eventually, by the end of this reform, about 1830, other professional music schools sprang up, specifically starting in Boston, that embraced the ideals of these musicians. You know, for instance, the most prominent of these reformers in the early 1800s was a man named Lowell Mason, a pious, religious man, and also a very skilled and trained musician. And he sort of sent out missionaries into the world, throughout the country, to bring these, you know, to spread the ideals throughout all of Christianity in the United States. And these Boston schools latched on to what Lowell Mason taught. They latched on to his publications. He created several compilations of psalms and hymns, and you know, eventually the ideals of Lowell Mason were embodied in the New England Conservatory, which is a school that I go to, you know, and New England Conservatory for, you know, about another century was firmly rooted in the ideals of Lowell Mason and the New England Protestant reformers. So, yeah, there were religious schools, and then there were professional schools that also adapted the same idea.
Hmm. Now, in these schools, you there's one line in your paper you talk about early 1800s, John Hubbard labeling the high-spirited fuguing tunes as perversion. Explain the high-spirited fuguing tunes.
So the high-spirited fuguing tunes were a direct result of the singing schools that the ministers set up. So fuguing tunes were highly energetic. You know, we may, if we have anything to compare them to today in our modern music, it may be something like a hoedown. Mm. These were very energetic performances, not necessarily improvisatory, you know, but you would take a melody, a high-spirited religious melody, and go with it, let it fly, and, you know, sort of a rompin', stompin', hoedown kind of religious music. And this got very popular once the musicians had been trained to read notation. The fuguing tunes were very popular among the people, and musicians tried to bring them into the church services, and the ministers, I mean, felt almost overwhelmed. You know, we've taught them to read the music, we've given them approved stuff, and now they still won't listen. You know,
right. Yeah. John Hubbard, one other quote in that, he said that these high-spirited fuguing tunes that he referred to as perversion, he said that they neither affect the heart nor inform the understanding.
Right.
And so, one of the you list the reformers' to-do list, which is not really their to-do list, but
right.
you put that together.
Right.
And when you read those, this kind of sums up what we've just talked about, but also leads into the next part of the conversation.
Sure. Yeah. So after reading these pamphlets and publications from over this century of the reformers, their desires, I summarize their desires in a 4-point to-do list. And this is what it may have looked like. Number one, unify the musical approach among all churches. Number two, use only correct and scientific harmonies and simplify the tunes. Number three, banish any musical style associated with secular ideas. And number four, eliminate emotionalism from the music. Now, these are words that come directly from their pamphlets, you know, correct, scientific, emotionalism. These are their sort of buzzwords, is there? Trying to reform the music.
So, if you can get inside their heads for just a minute, what are they hoping to accomplish by eliminating emotionalism? And yet, at the same time, what's the point of the music if it doesn't evoke emotion?
Yeah,
invoke emotion.
This is a major topic, you know, in this era. It's a debate over the role of music. I believe that the congregation in the music, the congregations in this time believed that the role of music was to express your heart, your emotions, and your feelings to God. And you do that however best you can. You take what you know from your background and you let the emotions come out through that. And the reformers saw music as having a different role. They believe the role of music should be to inform man, to elevate your tastes, to teach you. Not so much an expression of your personal feelings, your religious feelings in your heart, but rather when you sing music, the top goal, the number one goal should be that you learn something in your mind and that your taste is elevated.
So that goes back to his saying that fuguing music does not affect the heart or inform the understanding,
exactly,
which was their goal.
And if music doesn't do that, if music does not inform you, then it's inappropriate for a church service, no matter how much you may feel you are worshiping or how much you are emoting, you know, that's just unacceptable unless you are informed by the music in some way, whether in your mind or I think a lot of the driving force behind it was your taste. You know, these European tastes that these ministers had were definitely going to benefit your mind instead of this music that you may play, you know, in your living room at home.
So where does New England stand then in 1830 when the church is organized and through the first part of the church when they're still in New England? Is this where we are at this point in New England? How far have they moved in this reforming of music?
The reform is complete in New England by 1830. And their mission from this point was to spread it. And it was a very successful spread through missionaries, both, you know, gospel missionaries and sort of music missionaries that Lowell Mason and many of the reformers sent throughout the country. So New England was completely reformed. Music was careful. Music was controlled. Music was had been bridled and tamed. And the ministers were generally happy with the state of music in 1830. Now, the church, the LDS church, has not come from this reform. The LDS church, you know, 1830 is sort of on the Wild West frontier of Western New York. Mm-hmm. So when the church began, we were far from being reformed, very far from being a part of this reform. But, yeah, in New England, the reform was complete and it was spreading quickly.
Well, and we were not an offshoot from any of the other religions. We didn't come from the Protestants or the Methodists, the Catholics. We were a completely new religion.
Exactly. Yeah, and we're a completely new religion. And our music, early LDS music, was very different from what you would say was happening in the rest of New England in the 1830s. Maybe we could talk about that for a few moments. The New England Reform entered the LDS Church in 1837, 7 years after the church was formed. For those 7 years, the LDS sacred music was vastly different from what we know it today. Singing in tongues was a very popular practice. In casual atmospheres and also in the most sacred atmospheres, the Kirtland Temple dedication, there was a duet sung in tongues by two sisters in the church. Many of Joseph Smith's most sacred meetings with the brethren were accompanied by singing in tongues. You know, you read about this in the history of the church in the early Kirtland days, that they would sing and pray and speak and prophesy all in tongues, you know, and there's great rejoicing with this practice. Generally the way it would work was there was someone who would sing in tongues for the congregation and someone who was blessed with the interpretation of tongues. So someone would stand up and sing a tune. No one in the congregation had ever – no one understood the words in the first place, and no one had ever heard the tune before.
So it wasn't just the words that were this inspiration. It was also the melody.
From historical accounts, that seems to be the case, that usually the tunes were new as well. And they were different from the rest of what you may see as a holy roller kind of musical attitude, where this was not a wild, out-of-control musical moment for them, but rather it was – it was graceful. It was careful. It was beautiful, these melodies that came when people were singing in tongues. And then you have the person interpret and say what that hymn meant. And we have record of some of these hymns. You know, there's a beautiful one about Moroni, one that came forth in one of these meetings, and many others that you can read and go find what these singing in tongues actually meant.
I recall in your paper there was somebody writing about, I think it was Lyman White, singing in tongues, and they were saying that it was the most melodious tune they had ever heard.
Yeah, that's how the congregation responded. Right. The most melodious tune they'd ever heard, and it was a tune none of them had ever heard. An entirely new tune with words they didn't understand until the translation comes out.
Too bad we didn't have a musician writing it down.
I know, that would have been nice.
The tune down.
Need someone who can notate music.
So let's go on with the music in the church and how that progressed. And our end goal here is to find out how we got where we are today.
Okay. So Joseph Smith loved music. He saw music as an essential part of the service. When he was preparing for the Kirtland Temple dedication, he envisioned grand, majestic choirs singing the praises, singing hymns, singing, you know, praises to the Lord. And so he wanted to create that in the church, create those choirs on earth. And so in 1837, after the dedication of the Kirtland Temple, he appointed a man named Jonathan Crosby to be the head of the first, what Joseph Smith called, singing department. And Jonathan Crosby was the beginning of the introduction of New England sacred music reform. Jonathan Crosby had been trained in the Lowell Mason singing schools in Boston. So his views of what sacred music ought to be come 100% textbook out of the New England reformers. And so he began to teach vocal lessons to the saints, and he began to lead the choir, and the reform was begun. You know, eventually through the hardships the church faced in the next couple of years, reform was put on the back burner. And once things got settled again in Nauvoo, the reform continued. Saints began to flow into Nauvoo from England, and their musical tastes were more sophisticated than, sophisticated, so to speak, than the saints who came from, you know, the wild, wild west, you know, western New York and thereabouts. And a man named Gustavus Hills was appointed to take over the music in the church in Nauvoo. He was also straight out of New England, trained in the singing schools, 100% believing in the Lowell Mason approach. And we can see, to me, Gustavus Hills was a major turning point for the church. He was appointed as the director of the Nauvoo Musical Lyceum at the University of Nauvoo, which Joseph Smith had founded. And I found the resolutions that Gustavus Hills and the other members of the Musical Lyceum came up with in December of 1841. I'd like to just read a couple of their resolutions. Mm-hmm. From this meeting, resolved that we will adopt the manual of instruction published by Lowell Mason as a textbook for the examination of teachers in the elements of the science of music and as a guide for instruction in the art of sacred singing in the schools of this city. Voted that approved teachers shall receive from the board a certificate of qualification under the signature of the professor as president and countersigned by the secretary. And resolved that for our own improvement in the art of music, and with a view to extend and elevate musical science, we hereby form ourselves into a Lyceum of Music, to be styled the Teachers' Lyceum of Music in the University of the City of Nauvoo. Now, there are some key words in here that signal a dramatic shift in the LDS attitude toward music. Whereas music before had been a time to rejoice, a time to express your feelings, a time to be taken into sort of an otherworldly spiritual atmosphere, now you have these words introduced, science, the science of music. Music had never before been a science among the saints. The art of sacred singing. Now, it's an art as well. If something is a science and an art, it requires training, requires careful instruction from teachers who have a certificate saying that they are qualified to teach you this science and this art. This is intimidating to Latter-day Saints who, come from the regular, regular person musical background, on the frontier of America. People who had previously felt comfortable just singing in tongues in front of a congregation without any training now are completely intimidated, and not only intimidated, but are told no longer do they have the authority to direct the music until they get a certificate from these teachers of the science and art of music.
Hmm. How long did it take them to actually implement this? Were they able to do that? Before they came to the valley, to the Salt Lake Valley?
No, it took a long time. The music reform among the saints was cut short, with the death of Joseph Smith and the move out west under Brigham Young. Reform was took a backseat to everything else, to survival, really. And after a couple of decades of settling in Salt Lake, the reformer spirit began to come forth again, and the younger musicians in the church began to take up those same ideals that had been taught, you know, in Nauvoo by Gustavus Hills and Jonathan Crosby and many of the other reformers. And that is when, you know, about the 1880s is when young musicians in the church began to say something needs to be done about the music, and that thing that needs to be done requires that we latch on to that New England reform. And so they began to make sort of the pilgrimage back to Boston. You know, the youngest and brightest often did make that pilgrimage back, particularly to New England Conservatory, to study there for a year or two, three or four, and then return to the Saints and try to act as sort of a pioneer, a catalyst to finally bring about the reform.
Again, it's interesting that they don't ever consider, I mean, the LDS Church never considers doing away with music, just as the reformers did back in New England. They never considered that. But as I was reading through here, and you mentioned that in all the scripture that we have, we only have, is it two lines that talk about music?
Well, some more talk about music. There are two lines of instruction about music.
Two lines of instruction about music.
Yeah, out of, you know, Joseph Smith published 870 pages of scripture. At least that's what our modern edition has. And out of these 870 pages, two sentences give explicit instruction about music.
And yet, those two sentences, when I look at them, we learn from that having a hymnal is not an optional thing. It's a commandment. We will have a hymnal.
Right.
Which right there you're saying we're not going to remove music from the church because it's a commandment that we have it.
Right. Yeah. The Lord said it was pleasing to him to have a hymnal in his church, and he commanded Emma to do it. So yeah, it's not an option for Latter-day Saints to get rid of the hymnal and to eliminate music unless we
want to
get rid of that verse, you know.
We want to go against what the Lord has commanded.
Right, exactly.
So you're talking now, they've decided, you said 1880s, they've decided we need to really do something about the music.
Right.
And so a bunch of musicians from Salt Lake go back to New England Conservatory in Boston.
Right. Evan Stevens was the first to come back. Evan Stevens came back to New England Conservatory in the 1880s. And studied for 1 year, studied intensely under George Chadwick, who was the president of New England Conservatory back in the time. And one of the advantages of being at New England Conservatory right now is that I've had access to the student records of these LDS students. You know, you can go and find out from the LDS church records which people came to New England Conservatory, and then go into the vaults at the conservatory and find their records. You can see who they studied with, how well they performed, you know, and if you know who they studied with, you know exactly what things they were learning, because these were powerful, popular teachers who wrote textbooks, and you can go and see what they did. For instance, Evan Stevens completed 1,000 counterpoint exercises in his 1 year at the conservatory. Counterpoint exercises are, you know, supposedly the objective is to help you create an artful and beautiful melody. But the main thing is that that artful and beautiful melody needs to conform precisely in every respect to a very rigid set of rules. No matter how good the melody sounds, if there's one note that doesn't follow the exact rules, it is incorrect. And so he completed 1,000 of these and an unspecified number of what he called corrected harmony exercises. And these were where his teacher, George Chadwick, would give him a melody, you know, what we might know today as a hymn melody. And it was harmonized nearly correctly with a few subtle mistakes in it. And Evan Stevens' job was to go through and scrutinize every chord and find out where those mistakes were and to correct it and turn it in and see if he had done it correctly. This is how he spent his year, in being correct, following the rules. And George Chadwick, in fact, saw himself as sort of a prophet. You know, he wrote that his mission... George Chadwick was his teacher at New England Conservatory, the president of the university of the conservatory at the time. He's a musical prophet, and he said that his mission was to make war most violently upon all false prophets, false teachers, all frauds, and all shams. This is not...
As far as music is
concerned. Yeah, this is his musical mission, that he sees there are musically false prophets out there who are so close to the truth, yet there is incorrectness in them, you know, and they're to be rooted out and destroyed. You know, that there are musical frauds out there among the religious music community, and he saw it as his mission to make sure that each of his students was able to detect those false prophets and eliminate them and bring correctness into the world of sacred music.
And so did Evan Stevens follow that idea?
Right. He, I mean, I don't mean to especially single him out, but he was the first and, mm-hmm. and maybe the most public figure among these New England Conservatory students, because he was the director of the Tabernacle Choir for a few decades.
And if you look in the back of the handbook, you see his name.
All over the place.
All over.
And so, but he came back with the same attitude that, you know, returning to Utah, he said, wow, something really does need to be done. And so he took it upon himself with a few of the other people with the same spirit of reform to create their own psalmodies or hymn books that would conform to these correct principles. And they spent several decades trying to convince the saints that the correctness found in these hymn books would help them in their worship much more than what they were currently doing would help them.
Hmm. Wow. So he was, Evan Stevens, like you briefly mentioned there, director of the Tabernacle Choir.
Right.
And you can only imagine that when he got back here, the choir fell in line with his with his style of music.
Right, yeah. They began to perform much more European music, you know. And, you know, not just Evan Stevens, but other people who were leaders in the music, leaders of church music at the time, began to say, yeah, the European taste is, you know, far more elevated religiously than these Americans are doing. And so the Tabernacle Choir began to adapt its repertoire more to what you might hear in Boston, you know, at the conservatory or things like that.
So you say European music. This is European music at the time was more orderly, more rule-oriented. But we're talking a lot more about, rather than symphonic music, say, we're talking more about vocal music and choir music and hymn music.
Right.
But still European music,
yeah,
being
so
more orderly.
Yeah, that was the feeling of the New England reformers, was that if you are going to reform music to something that is correct, the thing that is correct is the traditional European way to harmonize melodies. And you need to use European-sounding melodies. You know, what you might have as very simple Bach chorales. You know, certainly most of the great European art music is much more complex than what the New England reformers felt that it was. You know, but mm-hmm. they tried to sort of boil down the essence of European correct music and taught that as this is European music. And so in New England, you get the Latter-day Saint students coming back and with these tastes that they believe are truly European.
So what triggered the real change in LDS church music once Evan Stevens had been back to the conservatory and others? What triggered the change?
Right.
I mean, something had to happen to change to end up where we are now.
Right. The most important event in the history of Latter-day Saint sacred music was when Heber J. Grant, who was newly called as the president of the church in 1920, formed the Music Committee of the church. This, for the first time, gave a group of professional musicians the religious authority to make decisions for church music.
Hmm.
From the time Evan Stevens returned from New England Conservatory up through 1920, there was a massive struggle. You know, academically trained musicians were creating hymn books and publishing them, and they sold very poorly. While the other popular tune books the Latter-day Saints loved would sell tens of thousands of copies, you know, regularly.
So it's mirroring exactly what had happened in New England.
Exactly, yeah. The music is popular, and people see it's out of control and it's incorrect. And you try to do what you can, and it doesn't latch on. Finally, when the music committee was formed, things could change. So this music committee, Heber J. Grant appointed 12 professional musicians to be the committee, and you know, seemingly the most influential among these committee members had all been trained at New England Conservatory. Evan Stevens being one, who had just retired from his long tenure as director of the Tabernacle Choir. Margaret Summer Hayes had also been trained at New England Conservatory, and she was then the chair of the music department at BYU.
Mm-hmm.
Brigham Cecil Gates, had also gone to the conservatory, and he later would lead the instruction of church musicians. So this music committee now said, okay, now we can create an official hymnal. The church eventually gave the committee the go-ahead to create an official hymnal. And once this official hymnal or psalmody was created, all the others were removed from the pews of the church. These very popular songbooks that, you know, you could show up for decades at church and sing your favorite tunes out of this book on your bench is removed. You know, one week it's there, the next week it's not. And it's been replaced with the official hymnal of the church.
And when was this?
This was in the mid-1920s when this began to happen. You know, from 1920 when the committee was formed, that was one of their main desires, was to create a correct hymnal that would become the official sanctioned hymnal of the church. And that's sort of the beginning of the church's new attitude today, is that there is an approved hymnal. You know, it has been created by professional musicians and holds the stamp of approval of the leaders of the church. And this is to be the hymnal that you're to sing out of, rather than bring your own tunes and sing whatever songs you know, whatever song you feel is in your heart. So it's a new age. So that moment is seen certainly as the most important moment in shaping what we know today as Latter-day Saint sacred music.
And that hymnal is used throughout the world in the church.
It is, yeah.
The lyrics are translated, but the notation remains the same.
Well, rather, it's not that exact hymnal. There were several revisions.
Today's hymnal is used throughout the world.
There is today an approved hymnal, and it is used throughout the world. Yeah, and I guess that is where it will be very interesting to see how we react to the new cultural status of the church. We are missionaries throughout the world. We go and we spread the gospel to every creature, whatever country they're in, whatever culture they come from. Mm-hmm. Teach them about Jesus Christ. Help them be saved. Now, at the same time, whether we know it or whether we like it or not, we are also cultural missionaries to some degree, particularly when we hand these churches in Africa or South America or Asia our hymnal. We're giving them inspired text. You know, many of the hymns people believe were inspired. You know, certainly we don't see them as canonized like scripture, but we're handing them that text. At the same time, we're handing them Lowell Mason. We're handing them Cotton Mather. We're handing them New England sacred Protestant music reform. So the question I think we need to ask ourselves as we spread throughout the world is, will the Latter-day Saint Church finally be the vehicle to spread the spirit of New England Protestant sacred musical reform to every culture in the world?
Seems like the most obvious vehicle. I mean, the way we spread throughout the world.
Yeah, exactly. It is. And interestingly, that New England sacred musical reform spirit has nearly entirely faded from the rest of the Protestant world and from New England.
Interesting.
New England Conservatory is a very different school today than it was when Evan Stevens and Arthur Shepherd and many of the other early saints came to attend. No longer are they teaching the correct old European way, but rather they are embracing the world cultures and saying, if you come to the conservatory, you'll have a taste of this, a taste of that, and go do what you will with it. And Protestant churches at the same time are also fading from that spirit, going to a more enthusiastic form of worship. Lowell Mason does not have the stronghold that he once had on Protestant churches. Still, his stronghold remains in the LDS Church through our hymn book, and we are the primary vehicle to spread that spirit throughout the world at the time.
So here we're taking our hymnal with its notation into Asia, which for centuries has used a different tonal scale.
Right.
And now we're saying, no, sing with this notation. I'm wondering, and I don't know if you have any ideas, if this is going to happen, if people are going to start singing the way the hymnal says to, especially people who can't read music. They're not going to sing the tenor line or the bass line because they don't even know what it says.
Right.
What are your thoughts on that? I don't know if you've thought about how
that's
going to happen.
I have thought about it a great deal, and that's been an issue for decades, you know, as the church spreads to Africa and, you know, these far-off islands in Asia. You know, these people have no training in this kind of music. They don't know how to read it. Their religious music sounds very different from the religious music we're bringing to them. And I really don't know exactly what will happen. One thing I do like is the church's sort of embrace of the overall culture of these people. Mm-hmm. You know, it's my understanding that when a temple dedication happens in a foreign country, that there is also a cultural celebration mm-hmm. where, you know, dancers and musicians and artists and costumes and everything come from the area and are celebrated. You know, look at what you people are about. Look what you've created. You know, we now embrace you in the church and we celebrate what you are about. You know, still we bring in the old hymn book and, you know, perhaps we'll have to do something about it. I mean, it's a complex situation mm-hmm. where, you know, we have hundreds of different cultures, hundreds of different musical cultures. We can't say, okay, now we will do part New England four-part hymn chorales and part West African rhythmic, you know.
And everyone
systems.
Will stare at you yeah. dumbfounded. Yeah. What are you talking about?
Yeah. So, I mean, that's a real question we're asking ourselves right now, and I would imagine, you know, throughout the church, people are asking themselves that question. What do we do about this, you know? Mm-hmm. I mean, I'll be very interested to see what direction we go with music in the church next.
Let's jump back just a bit about the church music committee that
okay.
Heber J. Grant
right.
organized. What happened to that? How long did it last? And, I mean, it's not still there, is it?
There is a music committee today, but it's very different from what we first knew as the music committee. The music committee was disbanded in 1972, so it lasted 52 years. We have access to the minutes from the meetings of the music committee, and it's fascinating to watch it all unfold over the decades. The music committee, you know, followed basically the pattern of the New England music reform, saying, now here is some approved music that follows correct musical principles, mm-hmm. and now we will teach you how to sing it. So the school set up singing schools, and anyone who was in charge of leading music in their congregation would come to these sort of camps where they would learn the music, they would learn the notation, they would get advice on how to lead the congregations in it, they would be taught how to direct choirs according to these correct musical principles, and they were, phenomenally successful in just over the course of a few decades, getting a church with a wide musical expression to, you know, successful in getting them to produce this music in the hymn book very well, not just getting them convinced that it was correct, but performing it very well, and eventually, I mean, it seems like through you know, the music committee ran into some conflict with authorities from the church, with some general authorities. It seems that they, at one point, perhaps tried to push their power too far, tried to exercise too much control. We can go back and read some of the letters that they sent out to church music leaders, you know, in local congregations, seeking for a lot of control, requiring that if a congregation leader or a local choir leader wants to do something different than the prescribed program of music, they need to request approval. And then the committee will consider it and let you know whether or not that's approved.
And weren't they supposed to submit their lineup of music or something in advance to their local leaders or something?
Yeah, they were. They were supposed to get approval from local leaders. And in fact, one letter that was sent out in 1960, you know, had an approved program of music that was to be performed over the year.
That's what I was remembering. Yeah,
almost like a mm-hmm. Catholic liturgy.
That's right.
That you know, the first week in January, here's the song. It's to be performed with quarter note equals 62 beats per minute. Make sure you observe the dynamic markings closely. next week perform this piece, you know. And
if you go on vacation, they're going to sing the same song in that branch you're attending as they would back home.
That was the ideal, yeah. I don't know that this caught on very well among many people, but there was definitely that desire among many of the committee members to exercise control among the music, you know. And it's something that they felt deeply too, was that in order for music to play its ultimate role in the services, it does need to be controlled, and we have been given authority to control it, and we just want people to do it the way that we feel it should be done.
There's a line, something about if you make a mistake. Do you remember that?
Right. So after, in this letter in June of 1960, you know, that had many, earlier in the letter, they're saying, follow the markings closely, observe the indications closely, follow the detailed suggestions, mm-hmm. And in the end of the letter, before I read the end, also there was one moment where they suggested that choir conductors lead the choir, quote, like a chariot driver who drives four spirited horses abreast. You know, this is a man who is in control of this powerful vehicle. But finally, at the end of this letter, there was mercy. You know, the final phrase comes: we will forgive you a few wrong notes if necessary, if the choir will sing the words clearly. So, I think this spirit.
This is 1960.
This is 1960. Yeah.
See, this sounds like 1780.
Right. Yeah, it's exactly the same story. You know, if you study the Catholic struggle with music, then you're very acquainted with the Protestant struggle with music. If you study the Protestant struggle with music, you're acquainted with the Mormon struggle as well. I mean, it's the same story everywhere, that music is sublime. It is able to raise man to the heights of spirituality. But if it's not controlled, it's dangerous. Music is a dangerous thing. We need to watch it carefully. We need to have authorities who control it. And you need to obey the directions of those authorities in order to not really mess up your service.
Hmm. I understand that committee had a hymn competition.
Several, yeah.
And the first one, who won that competition?
The chair of the committee, yes.
Evan Stevens?
Yeah.
Who... clearly, his hymn would have been written perfectly.
Right.
Because that was what he did at the conservatory, was learn to write things perfectly.
Right, exactly. And in all of this, I don't mean to sound like I'm speaking poorly of Evan Stevens. He was an incredibly talented musician.
And I'm not speaking poorly of him. Yeah. I'm saying obviously he would win because he writes perfectly, and that was their goal.
Right. This was a powerful message the committee sent to the church, mm-hmm. was, we're going to form a new hymnal. And in order to get new music, we now encourage all members of the church to submit new hymns to us. There will be a monetary award, $25 for first place, $10 for second place, and all hymns that are deemed appropriate will be included in the new hymnal. And all the hundreds of hymns came in, and the winner, of course, Evan Stevens, who was able to write the most correctly. Mm-hmm. And, this was a message to the church that... now, if you want your hymns to be part of the hymnal of the church and to be part of our musical heritage, you will do it this way. Mm-hmm. We now hold up for you a hymn composed by a student of New England Conservatory, a school steeped in the aesthetics of Lowell Mason and the early Protestant reformers. And let this be your guiding light, so to speak, in composing your hymns. If you compose it like this, using these exact academic principles, we will publish it. And the first hymnal that the committee did publish had something like 39% of the hymns had been composed by committee members. Hmm. Really trying to get that academic correctness out there.
And a big percentage of those committee members having attended the New England Conservatory.
Right. At least the ones that were doing most of the composing had attended New England Conservatory, right.
So there we are with the New England Protestant music in our hymnal, like you were saying.
Right, yeah. And so when you pick up our current edition of the LDS hymn book, you can say that perhaps the greatest influence on this hymn book, and again, we're speaking music, not text. Mm-hmm. That's what I've been speaking about today, is the music, not the text of the hymns. But the music in this hymn book is, very much so a result of Protestant New England and the reformers that shaped the music from the 1700s through the early 1800s.
This is fascinating. So any final thoughts on music today, where we're going, what Gladys Knight needs to do?
I don't have any thoughts about what Gladys Knight needs to do, but I mean, I have faith in the revelation of the Lord that the song of the heart, you know, the song of the righteous is a prayer unto me. The Lord delights in the song of the heart. And whichever direction the church ends up going in our music, you know, whether we continue our current approach to music and we decide that, you know, perhaps the most practical way to spread the hymns throughout the world is just to keep it with that music and teach them so that we can all be a unified musical body. You know, whether we do that or whether we embrace all the other cultures and say, you know, use these approved texts, but by all means use your own music. You know, I mean, I just have faith that we will allow people to sing the song of their heart. You know, have faith that we'll do it, and at the same time, that's our big challenge, is when you come across a new group of people in a new culture, a new civilization even, you know, how can we as a church be a vehicle to help them sing the song of the righteous in a way that's acceptable to the Lord? You know, we go out and we want to help them sing with their heart and praise the Lord. And, you know, when we do that, the scriptures will be answered with a blessing upon our heads. So whichever direction we go, you know, that I think will be our main focus.
Great. Well, thank you very much. This has been very interesting.
Yeah, thank you.
We've been visiting with Daniel Henderson. You're listening to Legacy on the Mormon Channel.